Hello, my name is Dr. Thomas Round, and I'm one of the development fellows at the RCGP. And today I'm speaking to Dr. Kevin Barrett about irritable bowel syndrome, or IBS. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Thomas.
Kevin, tell us a little bit about your background. You're a GP and you have interest in gastroenterology.
That's right. I've been a GP for 20-something years. I've joined the primary care side for gastroenterology, and I've worked with the RCGP on a number of different projects, particularly inflammatory bowel disease. But I'm interested in all things lower GI, so IBS, microscopic colitis, celiac disease, all those sorts of things, but particularly from a primary care point of view.
Great to have you today, Kevin, and your expertise in this area. What do we mean by IBS?
IBS is one of those conditions that can have a wide-ranging diagnostic criteria to it. It's typically a functional bowel disorder. That's our current understanding of it. The symptoms are quite difficult sometimes to elucidate in primary care, but it tends to be a chronic disorder starting off in younger life and rather than some of the other conditions that occur a little bit later on in life as well. It has a wide-ranging number of symptoms. So you have a diarrhea-predominant IBS or a constipation-predominant or a mixed or an unclassified. So those are four main types of it. It tends to not have any physical manifestation, so it's not a particularly inflammatory condition, although there is some debate about that in terms of the actual microscopic pathology that can occur in the bowel. So it's often relapsing remitting, it often has a number of different triggers, but I think the key is it tends to be one of those chronic conditions in younger people that present. When patients come to primary care with this, they've often got an idea of things that it might be or things they might be concerned about. And it's difficult sometimes to kind of elucidate where to start in terms of investigations and where to go with it. So it's difficult sometimes.
It is very common, right? We think 10 to 20% of people?
Yeah, that's probably a variable one. We get variable numbers anywhere between 5 and 20%, although that varies. So in terms of point prevalence, it's probably a little bit lower than that. But lifetime prevalence, it's, well, pretty much all of us have had IBS type symptoms at some point, triggered off by stress, exams, those sorts of things. But it becomes a syndrome when it starts to have an impact on our everyday life.
I mean, we don't need to go into the diagnostic criteria in too much detail, but I understand there's NICE and then there is Rome criteria, which people can look at.
That's correct, yeah. So in the UK, we tend to go for the NICE criteria, although Europe and around the world, they use the Rome criteria. Rome's currently being updated, so there'll be some tweaks to that come. And Rome are kind of moving toward using the term DGI, so disorder of the gut-brain interface, rather than a sort of straightforward IBS diagnosis. But yes, there's a huge overlap between them.
Let's think about that first presentation into primary care. It might be that patients move practice, we've not seen them before, and they might have an IBS label code, or it might be a young person with no previous diagnosis. What's the first steps on that assessment and any sort of traps to avoid?
IBS is one of those conditions that generally patients tend to have the same envelope of symptoms throughout their life. And if things have changed, we'd think, is there something else going on? It's really easy sometimes to see a patient where they've had a previous diagnosis of IBS to assume that that diagnosis has been made in a thorough, comprehensive way. And also to assume that any other lower GI or even gynecological symptoms are related to their IBS diagnosis. So the diagnostic overshadowing can certainly play a part with this. If we see a patient who we've not met before or is particularly new to our practice, it is sometimes worth going back and thinking, have I got the diagnosis correct? Have I excluded other disorders? Because diagnosis of IBS is generally a diagnosis of exclusion. We rule out things, first of all, before we move on to kind of giving that firm diagnosis.
So it might be in that initial consultation, take a sort of history. And as you know, talking about bowels, and I guess people could be embarrassed about bowels, but I guess we should avoid that and just try and normalize, you know, tell me about how you go to the toilet and whichever terminology they use.
Very much so. It's absolutely matching the language to that of the patient. So I'd like to say we all go to the toilet. We all do a poo. There are lots of campaigns out there on social media. Things like breaking the poo taboo is a classic one. And I think we're sometimes still a bit reticent to talk about our bowel habit. And I think the evidence is that people would rather talk to a GP about their sex life than about their bowel habit. So we need to improve things.
What initial tests might we consider? So we're doing that fresh assessment. It's a new patient. You know, in the history, obviously, we check for red flags, bleeding, weight loss, etc. But maybe in that case, we haven't got red flags. It's a youngerish patient. What sort of investigations might we consider following that first encounter in primary care?
NICE NG12 is the key one to think about the red flags and for lower GI disorders, particularly bowel cancer. But there are other things, serious bowel pathology, we need to consider too. And like you said, unexplained rectal bleeding generally always needs some kind of investigation. Anything that's different to normal is important to exclude from the history. An examination actually is worth doing. So an abdominal examination, because again, we get caught out by abdominal masses. And it's always worth having a look at the patient to think, do they look anemic? Have they got other signs that might be important? So it's generally important to see them face to face at least once on their journey. We don't need to do a rectal examination for this unless they've got pathology that really clearly points towards a rectal pathology. And then we think, well, actually, what do I need to exclude? So the symptoms of IBS generally overlap those of lots of conditions. So we've ruled out the cancer type things. We know that NG12 says in women aged over the age of 50 with new onset lower GI symptoms, we need to exclude ovarian cancer. And there's going to be an update from NICE around this to tell us which patients should have a CA125 and which patients need to have an ultrasound scan. But assuming that we've seen the younger patients, so typically late teens, 20s, 30s, that sort of age group, and we've got a very clear history, it's been a chronic condition, they've got no red flags, then the things we need to think about are, have they got disorders related to food intake? So celiac disease in particular. Celiac disease is an important diagnosis to make because it's quite different from a gluten intolerance, although both can be quite disabling for people. It's also worth making sure that we've excluded inflammatory bowel disease. And an easy way to do that is to think about doing a blood test, because some patients with that either have raised inflammatory markers or they become anemic or have a low ferritin. And that's quite a good first step screening tool for IBD. And then we think about thyroid function tests, again, can be worth doing because an over or underactive thyroid can certainly affect the bowels and give those sorts of symptoms too. So that would be my initial sort of set of bloods that I do. And then there are some other tests we think about in terms of stool tests.
I think it's really important to don't exclude celiac. And for the blood test, is it the same as you would recommend not fully excluding gluten? Can that impact on the blood test?
Yes, it can do. So the celiac test is an antibody test. You have to have the presence of gluten in the body to actually produce that reaction that the test picks up. So Celiac UK and NICE say that to get a true diagnosis of celiac disease, patients have to be eating gluten in their diet at least once a day for 6 weeks before the test is done. Now, that doesn't mean that if you get a positive test, patients are eating less gluten than that, that's not a true positive. But if they've not done the full 6 weeks and they get a negative test, you can't really say it's a true negative test. So it's worth having a look back on the notes, because people have often had a celiac test done in the past and it's been negative. It can be quite hard to know whether they actually have had a true test. I tend to write when I see the blood results that come back, if I see a negative celiac test, I'll write negative celiac test as long as gluten was consumed for 6 weeks before test was done. Yeah. Trying to kind of find enough text within the limitations of the character count to reflect that.
That's a really good top tip. Thank you, Kevin. I always have the back of my mind, roughly, we think 1% of people celiac, 1% IBD, inflammatory bowel disease, and, you know, as we've said, 10 to 20% with IBS.
That's true. Although I think all three of those figures are probably underestimates. I'm sure there are more people out there that we're aware of.
Yeah, absolutely. We've done the bloods and then thinking about the stool tests. And I think with the stool tests, it's always making sure patients understand how to do the tests. I think we've all, as GPs, had tests that come back, either not being returned or leaking or not labelled. So I think that's all the practicalities of doing it, isn't it, is really important with our patients.
Very much so. There's a really useful website that's been produced in conjunction with the BSG, British Society of Gastroenterology, and the RCGP, and Crohn's and Colitis UK, and other charities called What's Up With My Gut. And that has a diagnostic pathway on there for healthcare professionals and for patients. There are also a set of podcasts and videos and things on there about actually how to do a fit test and a calprotectin test on there. So again, the old-fashioned test where we kind of have to get patients to do a sample into a container, so the old blue-topped typical ones with the spoon in it, lots of those now are being transformed. So the fit test is generally done with a swab type test that you don't have to actually collect any poo. You can use a container in the toilet to do that as well. And lots of labs are moving to the same technology for the calprotectin test. So it's less messy for patients to do. And they just follow the same process as for a fit test, which lots of people, particularly if you see a younger person, that the parents may have been sent a fit test in post as part of the national bowel screening campaign. So it's definitely easier to do. But yeah, labeling the test is really important. I personally print off the label and stick it on and give it to the patient so that it's done there and then. It's frustrating for patients and for us to see a sample that comes back that labelled and a test can't be done.
So obviously Calprotect, I think the research is it's a good rule out test. So as I understand it, it's a test of inflammation in the bowel. So in a way, it's that bit non-specific about what the cause is. But if it's negative, you can be fairly certain there is not inflammation at that point in time. So it's kind of IBD rule out.
Yes, that's right. So the calprotectin is a calcium binding protein that's released in the presence of inflammation. So it's present in any fluid where there's inflammation. You can measure it in pretty much any part of the body. But in the fecal calprotectin is useful because if there's inflammation inside, particularly in the lower gut, then the levels get raised. Although there are a few things that actually also raise the levels. If you have a gut infection of any form, gastroenteritis, whatever it might be, diverticulitis, those sorts of things, then you get inflammation in the gut and you get a raised calprotectin. And we often see patients referred to gastroenterology with a very short history of bowel symptoms, and they've have a raised calprotectin, they get referred on, and by the time they're seen in secondary care, everything's settled down again as well, and it turns out it was just a straightforward gut infection.
seen that in my own practice. So I guess the key thing is an acute history, probably don't do it. Think about travel history. You know, obviously we think about other differentials, aren't we? A sort of traveler's diarrhea or gastroenteritis. Think about your stool microbiology. And then I guess if not improving after a certain number of weeks, maybe then to do the calprotectin. And if it's raised, patient's getting better, consider redoing it, I guess, or advice and guidance.
That's right. If they meet NG12 criteria for a suspected cancer referral pathway, then that's very different. But if they don't, then it's worth waiting maybe 6 to 8 weeks of symptoms before you think about doing a calprotectin test. And again, if you see a borderline raised calprotectin test, so most labs generally these days use either 50 or 100 as being the lower limit of what's normal, and sort of 250, maybe 400 as being the upper limit of where you need to refer somebody on. But there's that quite wide range in between the two. And if you get one of those, you think, is it because they're on anti-inflammatories? Is it because they've used a PPI? Is it because there's something else going on? Or sometimes you get just transient levels that they're increased. In that case, it's worth just waiting again about 6 to 8 weeks and checking it again.
Just, I guess, when to do a fit. I mean, definitely at nice NG12 patients, it's like the older cohort maybe, or gut feeling, you know. I'm quite liberal about doing a fit approach because we are seeing a little bit more bowel cancer in young people. So I think if you have got that gut feeling, it doesn't feel quite right, they've got some bleeding, I think probably having a low threshold-ish to do a fit test is okay.
Yes, I agree. When FIT first came out, I was quite sceptical. I thought, how are we going to use it? But actually, I can really see the benefit of it now. And I do it far more often than I think probably meet the NG12 criteria. But it's a very useful test for all sorts of different things. And even in patients who actually have active lower GI bleeding, as long as you tell them to swizzle the cotton bud bit into a bit of the poo that doesn't have any visible blood in it, the test is still valid, even in those situations where there is visible blood that's coming out.
Yeah, and just signpost people, I think we do have a podcast on FIT testing, and also we're going to have an updated cancer module, which we'll discuss a little bit about FIT in more detail coming up in the future. So do look out for that. So maybe we've done a FIT or not, and that's negative, calprotectin negative. We then reassess the patient. So we're pretty certain it is IBS, you know, and you might have that in your initial consultation. I think it's likely IBS, wouldn't you? You might code sort of symptoms, bloating. I often will ask patients, they may have done that already, but keeping a food diary and having a think about any triggers, I think it's really helpful to come back to the second consultation.
That's true. I think the problem with most of our clinical systems, it's very hard to code a suspected diagnosis. It's either IBS or it's not IBS. But I think it's worth thinking, actually, if you've done the test, the bloods are negative, they've not got any red flag symptoms, their calprotectin's very low, you can be fairly confident that 99% of those patients are going to have IBS. There are a small number that have other conditions, so bile acid diarrhea or microscopic colitis and a few other things. But it's definitely worth a trial of treatment in that situation. I think one thing that's really important with this group of patients is to make sure that we actually have a good relationship, a good rapport with them, and continuity of care can be really helpful for that. And I know these days it's really difficult to do that, but if we can try and maintain that and see the same patient to kind of talk through the test and build up that rapport, I think that's particularly important for this condition. Sometimes it's very easy for us to think, well, I just need to reach for the prescribing option and give them the medication. But this is one of those conditions that is really amenable to lifestyle advice. So talking about stress, relaxation, exercise, all of those things are really important. Fluid intake is important as well, just to make sure patients are hydrated enough, but not overhydrated, because again, that can sometimes trigger off symptoms in some patients. And then think about the sorts of things that they are eating. Some patients will say, it's very clear to me that I've eaten certain things or have fizzy drinks and lots of caffeine. That sets my symptoms off. Other times it can be trickier to do that. And keeping a food diary, it doesn't have to be very, very precise, but just keeping a general idea about the sorts of things that might trigger off can be worth doing. And things like single food exclusion diets can be helpful. You've mentioned gluten before as part of celiac disease, but quite a lot of patients do prefer to avoid gluten because they know that's one of those things that set their symptoms off. But there's a whole range of other things that can do that. The other thing that's worth talking about to patients about is fiber. And we don't talk about fiber as much as we should do. We know it's a wonder food. It's reduced the risk of bowel cancer. It helps sort of a whole range of different symptoms, but we're not taught a lot about it at medical school. So the difference between soluble fiber and insoluble fiber and the different sorts that happen, that can be quite tricky for us. The general rule of thumb about the 5 a day fruit or vegetables, that's a bare minimum. The official guidance is that women should really aim for 7 bits of fruit or vegetables per day and men should aim for 9, which can be a struggle. But trying to get 30 portions of fruit or vegetables per week is another way of thinking about it. And also trying to get 30 grams of fiber in the diet, but trying to measure that out, it's quite difficult to imagine that. But there's some things we can talk to patients about to say, actually, just any increase in fiber intake generally is a good thing. Although clearly you get some patients that don't tolerate it, so it needs to be tailored slightly.
Yeah, and I find some patients struggle with this a bit. I always just give the analogy, like, do a simple swap, like, tell me what you had for breakfast this morning. And it might be just like a simple swap, having more oat cereal, for example, for switching that. And sometimes it's particularly if they have constipation, as you say, increasing the fiber with fiber gel, I find that can be helpful as well. What about sort of over-the-counter or other recommendations for medications or other interventions?
there's lots of things. So again, patients will often try things themselves. And if they go into their community pharmacy, that they'll often be given antispasmodics, so medication that can help. So hyoscine, particular one that's used, peppermint, that's also used. So there are a number of different antispasmodics that patients can try, and that can certainly relieve some of those smooth muscle type symptoms that they can get. Patients often try probiotic, and probiotics absolutely can be definitely worth trying. There's increasing evidence that probiotics can help in IBS. The trouble is, no real clear guidance yet as to which particular strains or combinations of strains and cultures that can help. But the general rule of thumb with that is to try it for maybe 3 or 4 weeks. If the patients feel it's helping, then it's worth continuing. So those are the very straightforward things that people can do.
And then, you know, we might have that sort of discussion with the patient. They've done a food diary, trying over-the-counter medications, but they may be getting quite severe symptoms. It's bothersome. What next? I guess we could think about some evidence for CBT, that sort of psychological type interventions, and maybe some evidence for prescribing as sort of second or third line.
Indeed, CBT can be absolutely fantastic for IBS. It's one of those treatments that's really straightforward. It needs patients to be engaged and understand what's going on. So spending a bit of time discussing the rationale behind it, how it can help, is worth doing. And I think that's one of those bits where establishing that rapport and the continuity can help. But again, it's just choosing the right option for the right patient. And there's strong evidence that telephone-based and remote-based CBT can be just as effective as face-to-face CBT. So people that are busy, that they've always got that option. Medication-wise, there's increasing evidence that medication like amitriptyline can be quite helpful. There was a really interesting study that I think it won Research Paper of the Year a couple of years ago from the RCGP about the Atlantis trial, so the amitriptyline low-dose trial, which was a proper randomized double-blind study that was published in The Lancet. So that showed that actually for the right patient, amitriptyline can be really effective for IBS. So that's worth doing. We sometimes find patients, if they go and see a gastroenterologist, that they might use drugs like ondansetron, which is not licensed for IBS use, but actually is fairly widely used for IBSD. Remember, when I started, ondansetron was one of those drugs that cost a huge amount of money, but it's actually relatively cheap these days. So even though it's off license, it's something that can be considered with the support of a specialist, either through advice and guidance, perhaps. So that's definitely worth doing. I think the other thing that's also worth thinking about is the diet modification. So in an ideal world, we would all have a dietitian sit next to us in our surgeries. I think they're absolutely fantastic and they can make the world of difference to patients. The FODMAP, the fermentable oligo and disaccharides, that approach is definitely worth doing. It's very easy for us to say, oh, go and look it up on the internet, give it a go. And I think sometimes that can work, but we often find that patients, they do the initial exclusion part of it, but then they don't do the reintroduction and the personalization aspects, and those are the bits that can take time. And I think that's definitely where a dietitian can be helpful. Again, some areas have got access to dietitians remotely. They offer group-based therapies, online support if you haven't got one locally, but I think we should use them more than we do.
That's a really good tip, isn't there? I do signpost people to FODMAP. And again, it depends on patient health literacy, their ability to sort of understand the information. So I think that is a bit of a gap, really. It's difficult to get a dietitian in my area, probably very similar for other GPs as well. And we need to refer to secondary care. And I guess that comes on to my next question about when do we refer into secondary care? I think we kind of answered that already. If we're thinking of the serious pathology, obviously, if any of the tests are positive, FIT or calprotectin, and these are not settling down, we're a bit concerned, then we would obviously refer those patients, particularly nice NG12, we'd refer those 2 week wait. But then it'd be those patients with that severe IBS, we've tried first, second line treatments, we're sort of not really getting anywhere, then that might be advice and guidance for secondary care.
Yeah, there's, again, different ways of doing that. We do get some patients who just are adamant that they absolutely want further investigations done, and having a colonoscopy can be beneficial in that group, just to say, actually, we've had a proper look, we've ruled out everything, that there's nothing else going on. Clearly, we don't want to encourage patients to have unnecessary investigations that are potentially risky and would kind of delay treatment for other patients, but sometimes we just have to do that. Advice and guidance can be incredibly useful. It's really a really good way of getting that support. Also, in some areas, they are setting up community-based clinics run by GPs with specialists in charge of GPs extended roles in gastroenterology. There's a training program that's being launched with NHS England at the moment to train up a number of GPs to do that, and supporting patients with functional bowel disorders is a key part of that. So they've got additional time, additional expertise, support of the consultants, as well as extra training to help manage patients. So that can be really useful. But again, the other group, again, I've mentioned this before, and it's only a very small percentage of people, but things like microscopic colitis and those conditions, again, that can present in a very similar way to IBS. And we might try initial treatments and patients just, they don't respond to it. And we think, well, actually, is there something else going on? Have I missed something? And in that group of patients, particularly those with just profuse, persistent diarrhea, or some patients going to be housebound because of it, that group of patients, they would warrant a referral for further consideration of other tests and investigations too. So I think we need to use our sixth sense. Colleagues sometimes call it spidey sense. There's something else going on. There's this
gut feeling, yes. I think we call it gut feeling in the sort of cancer world. So I think there was some good evidence about gut feeling. It's useful, and you should reflect on it, as you say, about that continuity, getting to know the patient. Something doesn't quite feel right. Do I need to reinvestigate? Ask ask a colleague for advice, refer the patient, reassess. I think that's always a sensible approach.
Indeed.
And then just about the British Society of Gastroenterology, if people want to get more interested, as you say, there's these more extended roles coming on. Any sort of top tips? I guess you can have a look at the website and other materials on there.
That's right, there's lots in there, and GPs can either join the Primary Care Society for Gastroenterology, they can also join the British Society of Gastroenterology as a primary care member. And there's lots of resources out there, lots of education and lots of support from colleagues with this interest too.
Yeah, do have a little look at the RCGP website as well. We've touched about cancer today, haven't we? So we've got some cancer modules, some cancer podcasts coming on, stuff about fit testing in more detail. And we also have an IBS module, which people might be interested in having a look at. Kevin, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it. And really good, great to chat to you about this important condition.
Pleasure. Thank you very much.
And thank you for listening to the RCGP podcast. My name is Dr. Thomas Round. Thank you.